Today is Monday, July 22nd, and you're listening to The Job. This is The Job, a talk show about art, design, music, business, culture, and Portland. I'm your host and your dear friend, Ray Briglip. Our guest on episode 20, the second, is Kate Bingaman-Burt, illustrator, educator, and maker of things. First, let's talk to Needmore's finest studio director, Candace. Hi, Candace.
Hi, Ray.
How are you today?
I'm feeling a lot of pressure today.
Are you?
Yeah.
Like,
who wants to listen to this? Let's just get Kate on. I've seen her talk.
Yeah.
She's amazing.
Right, we saw her at
TEDx. I've got to have, like, energy, you know, be funny. There's so much. I'm glad I'm going first. That's all I've got to say.
Yeah.
I'm glad I'm not Dan.
Well, he's although he recorded him first, he's going to be played afterwards.
Right.
So. You're just feeling nervous.
Just nervous, just, you know, it's a little starstruck, a little nah. It's going to be okay.
Okay. So there's nothing else you'd like to say about what's going on at Needmore? Any projects that you want to tell people about or anything exciting?
Well, I am thrilled about the fact that we are moving our studio.
Yeah.
I think we talked about that a little bit last week, but yeah. It's starting to become a little bit more of a reality. We visited the space.
Started making checklists.
Started looking at conference tables. That's the big thing. We've never had a conference space. This is amazing. And we have a huge display now. We're ready for that. But
that's going to go on
conference
the
table.
Yeah. We're not even really sure what size to get. So I think we need to wait until after the first when we go in there and look at the space.
Is there a secret? Like, is there a golden ratio of conference room space to conference table size? They did mention something about getting a table that would fit through the door, and I thought, how do you figure that out?
I don't know. Listeners, the lines are open. Just call in and let us know.
Nobody's calling.
We don't have lines. Okay. Space. Yeah, well.
So last night, right,
yeah.
We went to
the association dinner.
Association at Union Pine.
Mm-hmm. The dinner is made by the farm.
The farm. The food was great.
We got
to talk to a bunch of people that I've never met and some that we had.
Yeah.
And that space is fabulous. Just open.
Yeah.
Loved it. Loved all of it.
Yeah, it was cool.
And we were out a little later than normal.
That was nice.
So it's a miracle that we're here and chipper.
Yeah. It's great. It's nice. Those kind of things for, like, you know, inspiration and or networking are good. I gave out 4 business cards, so. I don't mean to brag, but. Of course, half of them were to people that I knew.
Just to show them your new card.
Yeah.
You know who I am. You know what I do. Here's my new card.
It's fun. Giving out business cards is fun.
It is.
Tell you what's fun, Elizabeth got us an embosser.
Right. We need to start giving out all kinds of
things. Just embossing the shit out of it. Every time I need a little paper towel to wipe my cheeks, I emboss it.
Yeah. What is the embosser for?
It's for embossing shit. Put something in there, a piece of paper, you stamp it, and then it's like a letterpress, but...
There had to be some reason that we started... That.
You know, honestly, I don't know if there is, but it's cool. Is there? What's the reason?
It's for the job.
Oh, for the job. So that when you come in and get recorded on the job, we send you away with a little loving gift. And there's embossing involved. So
now I can probably finally get the guests of my dreams on the show now that we have an embosser.
I can't believe you let Kate come here before the embossing happened.
We
Her gift had
about
no
it.
Embossing.
We talked about an embosser while she was
and
here.
Is she coming back? Is she like...
No.
Okay.
But on that subject, Kate Bingaman Burt is known for her distinctive style of illustration. You can see it in her two books on her website and in tons of other places as well. She's an assistant professor of graphic design at PSU and has a client list that would make a grown man or woman weep. Let's talk to Kate. Okay.
And I didn't live there for very long, though, but my my grandparents, they were still, you know, they're lifelong kind of Wisconsinites. And then my mom and dad, they were weavers, and we ended up in Missouri in, like, the early 1980s based off of, like, they went to an art show in St. Louis, and they were going down all these different back roads. And at the time, they were just looking for someplace else to move. And they found this cabin at the end of this dirt road in the middle of Missouri, and it was for sale. And they're like, let's move here. And my mom actually recently told me that she thought that they would only be there for a couple years, and they've been there now for 33 years.
Wow.
Yeah, so I grew up in Missouri. Okay, so my
you can see where I'm going with this.
Yeah, I know. Absolutely, it's confusing. So my mom was a fibers major when she was in school. And she just was a weaver, basically. Okay. So woven tapestries, pillows, shawls, things like that. And my dad was an engineer, and that he worked at, like, American Motors in Kenosha, Wisconsin. And my mom was a weaver, and he kind of hated his job. This was the late 1970s. And basically, like, they were pregnant with me, and American Motors was giving my dad crap because, like, they're like, you're not going to take that much time off whenever your wife has that kid. And then mom went into labor with me, and she was in labor with me for, like, 3 days, and they constantly were like, come on, you need to get back. And so then he quit, which I'm thinking about, I'm like, you quit the job right when you were having, you know, a kid. That's kind of crazy. And they both became weavers. And then they were weavers for 20 years. That was their job. So I grew up, like, we lived in this really small town in Missouri, but my summers were spent going to different, like, street fairs and art shows with them. You know, we go to Chicago a lot. They did several different East Coast shows, and so I would travel with them there. I remember going to Florida a bunch, and it was just super fun. So, it's a lot less hippie-ish than it sounds. It was they ran, like, a super tight small business.
Okay.
Yeah, and it was, I mean, they were in galleries, and they had, like, the small shops and things like that. It was, like, they caught the whole wave of craft from, like, the late 1970s, 1980s, where, you know, I feel like we're kind of in, like, the second or third wave of that, but they basically, their business kind of came to an end in the early 90s, when it just really wasn't that, like, in vogue to make things with your hands, basically.
Yeah, no, that does make sense.
Yeah, and so that, I mean, everything comes in waves. Everything is, you know, cyclical, and that just kind of died off, and now we're starting, you know, that's the last several years it's, like, been popular again. And my mom still does shows too now. She was an elementary school principal, and then she just retired, so I don't know.
you've also mentioned before that you were influenced or inspired by your grandmother,
yes,
who was, like, a children's book
illustrator,
yeah, absolutely, is that right?
Yeah, absolutely. She started doing children's book illustrations, like, professionally when she was 19 years old. So she went to art school in Milwaukee at the Layton School of Art, and she got her first gig when she was 19, and she was first published when she was 19. And from the ages of 19 until 75, 76, that's when she lost her central vision.
Uh-huh.
She was, like, absolutely full-time self-employed children's book illustrations. Wow. And she would always tell me that she like, it just, the jobs are super steady. She was really fun to work with and people really liked her work. And
that's crazy. Statistically, you'd think like there's got to be like everyone in America must have like seen her work by now.
Yeah. And it's also, she was part of that age too, that era where it was really wonderful time of like illustration, but it was a lot of times they just, their names weren't on anything, you know? And so she has tons and tons of coloring books and things like that where, you know, it is Nan Pollard, but then she did a bunch of other stuff that like they didn't want your name on it. Like she, it was almost like a ghostwriting for different, you know, different things. Like she would do Berenstain Bear stuff and she would do Curious George stuff and she did some Disney stuff. And it was just kind of like, okay, you can copy that style. We need you to work like that. And so she just, and lots of paper doll books. And
so were you around much when she was like just drawing? Working?
Yeah, okay. Absolutely. Like I would go and visit my like grandmother and grandfather. My grandfather was also an artist too. He was a portrait painter and he was did illustration stuff like that. But she was just always at, like all growing up through the 80s, I would go and visit her like a couple times a year. And then she would come and visit us. And I always remember she would always ship out a couple boxes of things that she was working on when she stayed with us for a couple weeks. And at night she would just sit there and work on stuff. And I would just sit there and ask her questions. And it was really fun. It was really, but it's also, and then she passed away last year and she was really interested in how the computer had changed the way illustrators work, essentially. And so it was just, I don't know, we would compare stories back and forth where I'm like, yeah, she's like, so you can finish something and then you just email it and they get it. I'm like, yeah, she's like, I used to have to like figure in how long it would take to like ship things off. And it's just everything is just so much faster. And it was, I don't know, it was fun to kind of like have these conversations about like the job basically with you know, this awesome woman who like worked in a kind of a similar way. And I don't know, I just love that. It was really interesting. So.
Yeah. So it's like, you come from a long line of creatives, I guess you'd say.
Not that original with my job choice. Yeah, there you go. I'm not that brave with like venturing out.
Right. Yeah. They say, doesn't fall far from the tree.
Exactly. It's like it's not so much of a risky venture, I guess.
Right. Well, no, but that's nice to know that you knew so many people who, like, I don't think that I knew anyone who made their living doing anything remotely creative. I mean, I guess it was more like my dad was kind of like an engineer technician type, and that just seemed like but then again, this was Cleveland, Ohio or something. It was more white collar. I don't know. People had collars there.
Had collars.
Yes, and that's how it was. You had a collar or get out of town.
But no, I mean, it's funny because it's like, I feel like I credit a lot to like growing up in that environment where, I mean, they were my mom and dad and my grandma and grandpa. I mean, they were huge permission givers to me to be like, it's not crazy if you want to make things with your hands, you know? And so, and I feel like I've talked to a lot of friends and a lot of acquaintances where it was just like such a foreign thing to be like, oh, I want to be an artist, or I want to like make this, or I want to like actually make something and try to sell it. And so it was just, I feel really lucky in that regard where I remember I was like 9 years old and I just told my mom, I'm like, I'm going to start a pin business and I'm going to take all these magazine images and mount them on foam core and like glue pin backs on the back of them, and I'm going to go to the 2 floral shops in town and try to sell them. And she's like, go for it, I don't care. Huh. I've always been pretty self-entertaining.
Yeah, that's so interesting. I think for a lot of people it maybe seems like just getting into something creative seems like you wouldn't seriously consider it full-time work, or you would consider it like, if you really want to do it, you have to be like the one in a million who's successful, like who's a big rock band or you know, a famous artist. But it's like, it does seem like maybe there's a renaissance in that in Portland, and it's gotten easier for people, and there's more outlets for that.
No, I agree. And I think I think that one of the hardest parts of doing anything creative is just putting yourself out there, mm-hmm. you know, and it's just like making something and sharing it with somebody. Like, that's terrifying. Mm-hmm. And again, like I owe a lot to my mom and dad and my grandma for, you know, not making fun of that and mm-hmm. and kind of encouraging it, but also not treating it like it was that big of a deal either. So it wasn't like, oh, look what you made. That's amazing. Oh, it's just yeah. kind of like, yeah. oh, cool. Go. I was, like I said, I was super self-entertaining because, again, my mom and dad, they had all these looms. I think I grew up seeing them work all the time. So they were always working on orders, shipping mm-hmm. on orders. Like, I saw how that infrastructure kind of worked, and I, you know, and I would go to shows and I would see how that went. So I was very much like, mom was always like, you never had a problem just kind of making your own fun, basically. And mm-hmm. I still feel like a lot of my projects are just like making my own fun for myself.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. So would you go to the shows with them uh-huh. and stuff?
Okay. Yeah, absolutely. I was, I think my mom, I don't know how she handled it, but I remember a couple of shows I would take it upon myself to be a salesperson. Uh-huh. Oh my God. I can't even imagine how obnoxious that must have been to have like a 10-year-old like come up to you. Do you have any questions that I can help you with? With, you know, and just like, I'm like,
let me tell you about the cloth here.
So annoying, so precocious. I can't even imagine. But I never remember mom going like, cut it out. But I do remember some like distraction and diversion tactics that were employed. Like, oh, Katie, you don't have to do that.
Right. So when did you move to Portland? Was it in 2000?
It was 2008.
Okay.
Is when I moved to Portland. So I went to undergrad in Missouri.
Okay.
And I was an English major there, and then I found like I discovered kind of like graphic design. It's still the irony of the whole thing is like my aunt and uncle are graphic designers, my grandma and grandpa commercial artists, illustrators. Like, I still just didn't want to do any of that, and I didn't even really know what graphic design was. Like, I just mm-hmm. I feel like it's just like this level of just awareness that just wasn't there. And I didn't start doing graphic design stuff until I was like late in college.
Mm-hmm.
I worked in Omaha, Nebraska for a while as a graphic designer, and then I went to grad school in Lincoln, Nebraska. And then my first teaching job was in Starkville, Mississippi, at Mississippi State University. And I was there for 4 years, and then I moved out here. And I've been here ever since. So
why Portland?
I to go back to the Jason Sturgill thing, I was interested. There was a lot of work that was happening in Portland. When I lived in Mississippi, I lived there from 2004 till 2008, and we were super isolated. And also, 2004 was around the beginning of kind of like quote unquote Web 2.0.
Mm-hmm.
And like, I remember Flickr was really huge at that time. I met and found a lot of different people that were working in ways that like I wanted to be working. I just kind of hit the internet hard, basically.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And I really sincerely feel that I made so many wonderful connections during that time period. And those people turned out, like, I've met all those people in real life now. Like, I think about, like, the illustrator Lisa Condon, who lives in San Francisco. Like, I first met her on Flickr.
Mm.
I met Frank Chimero through, like the early days of Twitter. And we discovered that, you know, he went to the same undergrad that my sister did in Missouri. And so, but it was, like, all these kind of, like, odd, funny connections that have turned into actual, like, IRL relationships.
Right, yeah.
And I don't really, at least for me, that doesn't happen nearly as much since I've moved to Portland. I think it's also because I'm in Portland now and there's other things that I can do.
Right, yeah, yeah. There's a big difference.
There's a big difference.
Sure.
And so, so Portland just seemed really appealing, but I also knew that, you kind of go where the teaching jobs are too.
Yeah.
And so when Sturgill contacted me about this tenure track assistant professor job that was open at Portland State, I was like, okay, let's do this. Because I had also, my husband and I had made upper minds too, that we were comfortable and we actually really liked living in Mississippi. There's parts of the South that I just absolutely love. We didn't like how kind of isolated we felt, but like we were very comfortable. We had tons of space, and I was about to go up for tenure if I had stayed there for another year, and we were kind of like, yeah, we could do this. And then, but we also decided too that if another job came open, it had to be to like these handful of cities that we would love to live in, and Portland happened to be on that list. Mm-hmm. And so that's how we ended up in Portland.
Mm-hmm. So what draws you to teaching?
Again, I feel like this, it's something again, and I feel like a lot of the things that I end up doing and loving, I never really set out to do. And I don't feel like I didn't go to grad school because I wanted to teach. I went to grad school because I had all these different ideas that I kind of wanted to like work out. And I went to grad school because I wanted to have like that gift of time. And the weird thing, my first year of grad school, I ended up like having a lot of kind of teaching responsibilities thrown onto me. Mm-hmm. And I also have this very naive thing where I am just like, yeah, sure, let's just try this and see what happens. Mm-hmm. I don't know, you know? And so that was exactly what teaching was. Like it was one of those things, like, okay, Kate, you're going to be teaching this type class and this graphic design one class. And I'm like, okay, I don't know what I'm doing, but I'm going to do it anyway. And I feel like I end up in a lot of situations where I'm kind of like that. And I discovered that I really loved it, but I mean, I still don't know what the hell that I'm doing. I'm starting this is like my ninth year of full-time teaching in the fall, but it's just like, I'm just figuring out as I go. Mm-hmm. And just like kind of remaining open to like, you know, remaining open to change and remaining open to like feedback. And like, it's just, I'm always feel like I'm just like retooling it, but I absolutely love it. Mm-hmm. And, I kind of love the, how it's like part prep, part improv, like also just part, there's some like performance parts to it. And then it's also it's just really fun to work with students too. That's the best part, is working with the students. That's like, I love my Nebraska students, I love my Mississippi students, and I love my Portland State students. And I don't approach teaching as like, let me tell you everything that I know, which that would be such a short and boring class. But it's like, what do you guys want to do? Let's figure this out. You know, it's definitely more of a, I don't know, this is cheesy, but more of like a facilitator / like coach sort of thing. And then just like, just talking it out and making things happen. And it's really fun. I don't think I'd ever want to stop teaching. And it's also so connected to, it makes my freelance work so much more fun, because I share with them a lot of the stuff that I'm doing in freelance. Mm-hmm. And then just like, they are really so awesome in like reminding me that what I do is actually really fun. Mm-hmm. You know, because mm-hmm. it's just like, I teach a class of sophomores every year, and it's just so much fun to like bring in different types of paper that you've become like so kind of used to, and then you show them to sophomores and they're just like, this paper is the most amazing paper that I've ever seen in my entire life. I cannot believe, and just like, I'm like, you're right, this paper is amazing. And so it's just, they.
What the hell kind of paper do you have there?
I know, it was just like normal paper, yeah. Like just paper samples. Like, right. I'll bring in paper sample books, like stuff that I feel like I could become totally desensitized to, because it's something that I look at like all the time.
Yeah.
And I'm like, oh, I got some new paper sample books. I'm like, oh, paper sample books?
Yeah.
Oh my God. Yeah. I'm like, you're right, these are awesome.
so you get a little bit of enthusiasm,
oh my God,
vicariously from
so
yeah.
much okay. so much, and just like seeing how quickly that they can like solve problems, and how quickly they become better designers, and how quickly that they learn. It's super inspiring for me just to kind of like see these like students learn and grow and get to know each other and like help figure out like what it is that they want to do. Like I do a lot of advising, and so that's really fun because I mean not every single person who wants to be a graphic design major really should be a graphic design major, but that doesn't mean that they're not going to be good at something else. And so it's just like talking that out. I don't know. It's a lot of talking, and mm-hmm. I really like those conversations. They're fun.
Okay. So a lot of your work focuses on the concepts and the ideas of consumerism.
Yeah.
Now I saw your TED Talk.
Yes.
But for our lovely listeners who haven't heard that, where does that come from for you?
Okay, I'll try to do a short version of it, but it really, I feel like it goes back to me being a kid. And like when my mom and my grandma and I would all get together, our social activity was shopping.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. And like the best conversations would happen around clothing racks, you know, the whole kind of like ritual of shopping. And so I would always associate like those good memories with consumption, which I know sounds really screwy. And then my grandmother would always send me like a box of brand new school supplies at the beginning of every school year. And so it's like I have this weird kind of like office supply, school supply fetish sort of thing. And it's like, I always feel like anything can be solved if you've got a new notebook, you know?
Right,
and it's
right,
just
right,
it's like
yeah.
all these like weird, it's like, and like these object connections and how, you know, and I think that's kind of when I started, and then also, you know, so that seed I feel like was planted, like these different stories and emotions being imprinted onto machine-made items, essentially, mm-hmm. and how everybody kind of has their own relationships with these objects. And again, like I think consumption is a super emotional topic, and there's a lot of material to kind of work with there too, because yeah, I mean, and again, and I do explore that in a variety of projects, but. The thing really, really I feel like kind of pushed me into using consumption as basically my life's practice, I guess, mm-hmm. is my first job that I had when I was out of undergrad. I was a graphic designer for this gift company in Omaha, Nebraska. And like my job, so I was like 21, 22, and my job was to like research trends, was to figure out how to develop, it was a gift company, so it was like we did a lot of candles, jar candles, potpourri, gourmet, I'm making air quotes, gourmet food, and then we would go to all these different trade shows and sell them to, you know, different stores and retailers and things like that. And so I was just immediately put into this world of trade shows, which is so plastic and such a crazy fabricated constructed environment, which was fascinating. It was also, so this was the late 90s, early 2000s when I was doing this, and I started seeing like all of these kind of crazy contrasts happening where like this was also during the era when Beanie Babies were huge, and so I would be in the same kind of like trade hall, like this booth that I had designed. Like I did a lot of like big booth designs too, of like trying to like fabricate all these different like homey country experiences for our shoppers. And I was really close to the Beanie Baby booth, and I saw people getting fist fights, like trying to get their fall orders in. And I was just sitting there and I was like, this is really, really, really effed up. And I'm like, and I am fascinated by this. Mm-hmm. And also during that same year was when the whole Monica Lewinsky thing was going on.
Mm-hmm.
And it had died down a little bit, and she like came back into the spotlight because she had a line of handbags that she was making. And so for a while I was basically following the same like trade show schedule as Monica Lewinsky. And like her booth would be set up with her Monica Lewinsky handbags, and it was just so weird. Yeah. And so I just started like filling up notebooks and just like different, just of just like writings about the things that I was seeing, and I was a salesperson for this company too, and I started kind of, and I did a lot of these shows by myself, and so then I just started like, and it was, I was selling the products that I had designed for this company, and so then I just started doing all this kind of like, what if I arranged it like this? Would it stop somebody and like force them to come? It was just weird. I did a lot of these like weird kind of little social experiments, like within the booth too, and then I was like, man, I can't work here anymore. This feels weird. I don't want to do this. I've got all these different ideas of other things that I want to make. And then that's when I started applying for grad school. Mm-hmm. And then that's when I became really interested in kind of like history of objects and stories behind objects. And then that's when I started tracking my own consumption too, because I did a lot of photo work with like thrift stores and yard sales and Target stores and interviews that's just like, you know, what I look back on it now, like some people that were almost like could have been classified as hoarders. Like I was just like kind of obsessed with why people were buying what they were buying. I didn't feel like I was able to really get like the stories that I wanted. And I think that's what kind of moved me to start tracking my own consumption.
Mm-hmm.
And so that's kind of where this all kind of came from.
Mm-hmm.
So you
were taking pictures of things that you bought for a while?
Yeah, personally? I did that for 28 months.
Okay.
And that's where obsessive consumption, like the term for that, came from.
Mm-hmm.
And it was all very tongue in cheek. I mean, it was like 2002 when I did that. Like my camera, I mean, cameras didn't have cell phones. Cameras didn't have cell phones. That's my camera has a cell phone. It might as well be. I never use my phone for talking.
So
I use
true.
Yeah. But I switched from film to digital and just like that whole kind of like, I don't know. I'm like, I'm gonna have a website. This will be crazy. And then I also archived everything in glassy envelopes and like meticulously filed the receipts and the photographs and date stamped things and like rated stuff. And then I uploaded them all to this website. And then people started like following that and leaving comments and contacting me. And then they would send me, for a while, I would just gather emails from people that would just, they would just send me emails of things that they had purchased for the day. And I made this big zine, I remember, many years ago, that was just, it was just page upon page upon page of small tiny type of like all the things that people had been purchasing and a little line about why. Mm-hmm. And that was just, I'm like, okay, cool, that project's done, what's the next thing? And
so you strike me as this might sound a little arty, but a consummate maker. Like you've always got these kind of like, you're like a scientist of art, you know, like you, every time I hear about these projects, it's just like, you know, not only do you just do this every day, it was like, well, maybe I write in a diary every day, but you will like catalog it and everything and end up like turning it into a product. Do you, when you start this sort of thing, are you thinking, you know, I bet 28 months from now I'll put out a, you know, you're not thinking.
No, totally not. Okay. There's so many different things. I mean, perhaps I should think a little bit more before I start projects, but I just, whether good or bad, I'm just going to start this and see what happens.
Mm-hmm.
And sometimes they hit and sometimes they miss. And then, you know, just kind of like with that first project, I was like, it's like, I mean, it wasn't like I started it like January 1st, I'm going to do this. It was January 23rd. And that was the thing. I'm a big fan of believing that like making through making basically, and it all like one project evolves into the next one. It runs into the next one because the photo documentation project came out of me just obsessively taking pictures of thrift stores.
Mm-hmm.
Because I do a lot of thinking through making, where a lot of the crazy kind of like where I would go to thrift stores every Thursday. And I'm also very regimented, like, with rules. I'm like, okay, every Thursday you're going to go to these three thrift stores, and you're just going to watch and look and take photographs. And it was during one of those trips that I was also happened to be looking for a couch for my studio. And I took a photograph of that couch that I knew I was going to buy. And then I was like, wait a minute. Now I'm gonna take a photograph of everything that I purchase. Okay, let's do that. And so then at that point, like, okay, then how is this going to be? What are the rules that I have to follow for that project? Just so I can kind of, like, keep going with it. Because I have to have some sort of infrastructure, or it's just going to be, like, all, like, nebulous and weird. And it's got to have, like, a loose system of rules, just so, like, I mean, there's some days where you're just like, I don't want to do this. Like, okay, this, make it easy enough that you can just kind of, like, follow those rules that you've set up for yourself and just do it and then carry on, basically. So, and, like, the rules for the photo, the first round, I mean, it was just take a picture of everything that you purchase. And then every Sunday I would sit there and print out the photos and put them in envelopes and date stamp them. And then I would, like, upload them all to this really super cumbersome, like, flash website that, oh my God, it took me, like, all day on Sunday, which sounds so pathetic.
I know, because now it's like, you know, in the days of Instagram now, it's like you don't even think about it. But
and it's like, hey, do you want to, like, there's this thing that's happening on Sunday. And I'm like, no, I've got to, like, upload all the shit that I bought this week. It just ridiculous. Yeah, yeah. But it was just like, I don't know, it's just...
So, yeah. I mean, it's almost like the having a set of rules of some sort of exercise like that. I think that at first blush, someone might think that makes it harder, but really,
it
frees you to not have to think through every time. It's like you just have to check off I just have to do these things, and then it's
absolutely. Done. And I've learned this, and it's been repeated and demonstrated to me so many times whenever I'm teaching too, like. Like, you don't want to have an assignment that says, oh, you can just do whatever you want to
right.
do.
Yeah.
Because you're going to end up making crap,
right.
basically, or not making anything at all.
Which is staring at a blank sheet of paper all day.
Staring at a blank sheet of paper and being like, what's wrong with me?
Yeah.
I'm so stupid. You know, and you just, like, go down right. to, you take it to that really dark place.
Yeah.
And so, like, I actually teach this, I teach a senior thesis class where on paper it's like, students can pursue their own, you know, independent ideas, and, you know, and so, like, oh, this will be so much fun. We can do whatever we want to do. But it's like we go through this whole series of, like, this whole series of exercises of how we can really, like, kind of, like, drill down to, like, what is it that we're going to be doing? What's your schedule? How are you going to execute it? You know, and it's just, it's not fun. It's just, like, I think about whenever you see this different kind of, like, this is just, maybe I've seen too many things like this where someone's put up, like, this big, it's like a public installation of, like, a blank sheet of paper, and it just says, get creative. And then it's like, here's some markers, here this, and it's just like a bunch of scribbles. Someone's, like, written poop, you know?
Oh, this, don't get me started. We had one of those out here for a while, and it drove me crazy because it was like, I'd be sitting in here trying to, like, do important whatever, and there'd be this thing out there that was like, it was like...
Like, come on.
We
need some structure.
Yeah.
Because it really, that yields more, like, it's just... Well,
constraints
more,
can be freeing.
Constraints are good.
Yeah.
Constraints are really, really, really good.
Yeah.
And within those constraints, like, really wonderful, surprising things can happen when you're following those rules that you've set out for yourself.
Mm-hmm.
So,
I mean, do you think when you're, like, these days, do you work a lot on a computer?
Yes. We had one of our friends came by the studio today, and he came in, and he was like, oh, you're making, I don't know, he was saying something like, making all this great stuff. I said, no, I'm just making lots of email right now. I'm making so much email. That's all I've done for the last 3 days is email. And he started to laugh. I'm like, oh, I just don't even know if I can laugh. But yeah, I spent a lot of time in front of the computer. And actually, so all of the drawings that I do originate on paper and I have my pens. But then it's like the only thing that doesn't get really touched by a computer is just my daily drawings. Mm-hmm. But they still get scanned and uploaded. Mm-hmm. But like all my freelance stuff, it starts on paper, pens, and scanning. And then the whole, like, then I just sit in front of a computer and I actually, oh my God, yesterday I ordered a Cintiq. And
oh, yeah.
I am kind of freaking out. It's coming tomorrow. I have just been repeatedly told by people that I admire and respect that this is going to, especially with my freelance stuff, like, it's going to save me a lot of time. It's going to cut out. And so I've just been the biggest.
Do you use a graphics tablet now?
No.
Oh, you just use a mouse? So you're going straight from the mouse
no,
to the...
No, I'm going straight from, or I just, I do, I like...
Oh,
I,
you're going to start creating on the...
Yes, I on see. The screen.
Oh.
I don't know if I'm
gonna, I'm curious how that'll work out for you.
I know. Because I've even tried doing like a tablet and a pen. I'm like, this yeah. feels stupid.
Yeah,
you
it's
know?
Weird because you're drawing here and it's over here and it's like you're used
I know.
To... Yeah, yeah.
I know. I
don't, maybe the Cintiq will work out for you. I don't know.
I don't know. I don't know. But I mean, like... There's just some freelance stuff that I know that it doesn't matter if it originates on paper,
right.
basically.
Yeah, yeah.
And, but yeah, it's like that whole, like, I've also been such a person. I'm like, I use pens.
Yeah.
I use paper. Blah, blah, blah. And so here I am, like, and now I have a Cintiq and I'm going to draw on the screen. It's like, what am I doing? What's happening?
Yeah. Wow.
Yeah. I don't know.
So in general, do you, well, it's hard after that you mentioning the Cintiq. I mean, do you think that, I mean, your daily drawings will still be on paper,
oh,
right?
Oh yeah,
I mean,
absolutely. That kind of thing. I've got this like crazy archive of drawings. Oh, that is still totally be on paper. And yeah. any, like if I'm ever doing like any, I honestly... And I this could come back to like biting me in the butt, me saying this, but like the only thing that I see myself using that Cintiq for would be for like quick turnaround freelance stuff where mm-hmm. it just doesn't mm-hmm. nobody needs the paper
right.
artifact. But mm-hmm. like I am such a huge fan of the tangible mm-hmm. that I mean, it's everything else is still gonna remain very like tactile
yeah.
and like object based and things like that. So, but we'll see. We'll see. I tell my students they have to be open to change and not be bratty and obnoxious. But I've been so bratty and obnoxious with the whole kind of like pen and tablet thing And that's the thing too. It's like I catch myself when I find myself feeling very closed off to things. I'm mm-hmm. just like, you tell your students that you really should remain open. And like, I'm just like, no. Like mm-hmm. when Vine first came out, I'm like, no, I don't need another social thing. You know?
Yeah.
And now I'm like, I never needed Vine. It's on Instagram now.
Yeah. Well, there you go. I'm curious. You're very good at having like those daily routines. Are you like that with like meals and stuff? I mean,
I get very. I know what I like, and I get really repetitive in that too. Like, there's some restaurants where I've only eaten the same thing,
okay,
and I've never
yeah,
tried.
Yeah.
Anything else on the menu. Uh-huh. Like right now I'm currently, Double Dragon is really close to our studio. It's a banh mi place. It's like a 20th and no, it's a 14th and Division.
Okay.
Really, really, really good. But yeah. I've only had one of their sandwiches and I've had that sandwich maybe 20 times. And like we'll go over and they're like, you want something different? I'm like, no, I know I like this.
So. You know, it's easy for me. I like banh mi. A lot.
Yeah.
And there was a Safeway down on 82nd here, and it was the worst. And I was so thrilled that it closed, and now it's an Asian market, and they have a little cafe in there, and they started serving food. But they have one sandwich, one roll choice, and then, like, the bubble tea, and that's all you can get. So it's like,
I love that.
Yeah.
I love that.
Luckily, it's good. But it's, like, $3, and it's so exciting. It's
that's
like, this
so
is
funny.
Great.
No, I get very, I develop habits very quickly.
Yeah. Yeah.
And to the point where people make a lot of fun of me. A lot of fun of me. But, you know, like, I know what I like, and if it works, I keep doing it until it doesn't work for me anymore, and then I do something else.
So you have an amazing list of clients that you've worked with. How do those jobs usually come your way? Or?
They all come because I at least they started. Like, it was because of my daily drawing project.
Okay.
And because, again, like, when I started the to do daily drawings, I started that in 2006, and it was after I finished drawing all of my credit card statements.
Right.
And like, to back up a little bit, like, I hated drawing. Like, that was not an area that I felt comfortable in at all.
Mm-hmm.
At all. I was way more comfortable with photography, way more comfortable with, like, installation, spatial things, like, just way more comfortable in that world. And like, drawing, no way. And I think that's the main reason that I picked drawing as the kind of the vehicle for when I was reproducing my credit card statements, because it was also just kind of a painful way for me to work too. But then you do anything for so long, you actually, at least for me, I discovered that I kind of sort of liked it.
Mm-hmm.
And so one of the reasons I started the daily drawing project was so I could draw something else other than my credit card statements. And so in 2006, that's when I started drawing one thing that I purchased every day, and then, like, had a little, like, story along with each one of them, and started publishing them on my blog and things like that. And I started that project not because I was like, I'm going to be an illustrator. This is going to be great. Like, it was just kind of a part of the way that I kind of process stuff and kind of work. And so that just was what I was doing. And then several months into that project is when people, like art directors, started contacting me asking to start working, like, if I would be interested in any freelance stuff. And I was like, huh? And I'm like, okay.
Mm-hmm.
And so that was, like, in 2007. And okay. I feel like I've been pretty busy with freelance ever since, like, freelance illustration.
Yeah.
And it's only been just recently that I feel, like, even comfortable calling myself an illustrator, which is bizarre because, like, I go to my website and everything on there is illustration stuff. But I've only just become kind of like, yeah, I'm an illustrator. Because I'm not a graphic designer, I'm an illustrator. I mean, I teach graphic design, but it's like, I practice illustration. I mean, that's what I love doing. And so I've been really, really fortunate that almost all my client work has come just really from, if I hadn't done that daily drawing project, I mean, I don't know what I'd be doing. I really don't. I don't know.
Do you think it was just the consistency of execution?
I think so. I feel like it's very clear. I feel like when an art director goes to my site, they know what it is that I do.
Right.
And so I feel like I've been really lucky in that regard too, where it's not like I've got all these, like, you know, I feel like with some, like I don't really know what this person does. This person's like, I like the work, but it's kind of all over the place. So I'm not really quite sure what, you know, what kind of job I would assign them. But, like, you go to my site and I feel like you can kind of, like, I know what she's about.
Mm-hmm.
And I have an idea for what she could do.
Mm-hmm.
So
I think, well, it's similar to our discussion about constraints.
Yeah.
It's like I think people want to be perceived. They think they'll increase their odds of getting work by trying to show all the different things they can do. But paradoxically, it's that clarity, consistency, you know.
Because, I mean, someone's going to look. I mean, I feel like sometimes art directors look at a person's website for, like, 15 seconds.
Right.
And if they can't figure out what it is, exactly, they'll go on to the next person,
like,
that they're supposed to look at.
Looking at a resume or
exactly.
something. It's like, is it there or not? Is
exactly.
it going to work or not? And,
exactly. But it's, again, that leads into questions about, you know, I mean, I think if you feel like specializing, that's fantastic. If not, that's fine too. So it's like, I feel like I get a lot of questions where, like, well, do you really feel like everyone should really specialize in one style? And, like, that's just what, this is what I do.
Yeah.
You know, like, you got to figure out what's going to work out best for you, you know, and try to rock that as best as you can.
Mm-hmm.
So, And this is just, this somehow seems to be working okay. So, but it's also been fun too, because like through drawing though, it's not just all like, you don't go to my website and it's not just all black and white drawings. Like my other earlier interests creep in. Like I do photo scene setups. Like I've been able to, you know, I still do installations and I'm still, like, I know it's just, it's like drawing's just kind of another component. It's a very dominant component, but I don't know. It's again, like within that constraint, there's a lot of things that I can do within that. So
a lot of your that work is commercial. Is it ironic at all?
Fully.
Okay.
Freaking okay. So one of the
just making sure you know.
Oh my god! It's like Oh my goodness. One of my favorite things though is the very, very first kind of rule-based project that I did is when I went to Target, because I was like totally fascinated, absolutely interested with Target. So this was like 10, 11 years ago when I was basically doing an installation where I was photographing and recording the sounds of shopping. And Target was great. Like I contacted the local Lincoln, Nebraska Target and said that I was just doing this project and if it would be okay if I could do it. And they're like, yeah, sure, no problem, which is absolutely unheard of, especially around that time. It was just 2001, 2002. Photographing in public was not the thing with all the 9/11s, it was crazy. Like I remember just like Walmart had it on lockdown. I got kicked out of malls. Like it was just like, I feel like photographers, like you couldn't be shooting at anything that without raising suspicion, but Target was great. And so like I photographed all these Target shoppers for several months, made wallpaper, like had model release forms, like did all these interview things, and it was really fun. And I feel like that was like kind of like the first project that I was like, yeah, I really like working in this way. Mm-hmm. And so then when I ended up doing work for Target in 2010, I was like, this is awesome.
I know, like full circle. That's funny.
Because I love, again, like I love kind of like when those full circles do happen. And so I was just like, yeah, the Target circle has been connected.
Yeah. That's cool.
So yeah, I'm feeling like I do like, and especially like I'm a big fan of anything that is like hopelessly meta too. And so it's just so that when I did the stuff for Target, like I drew the products that I did for Target. Like I actually went to Target and purchased the products that I had in the Target store. I drew them for a daily drawing. It was just like, again, it's like, and it's just, it humors me. It makes me laugh. It's just like, yeah, this is just kind of ridiculous and I'm fully embracing it. So
Your work, you in your illustration, you've sort of developed a typeface.
Yeah.
Have you ever considered making a typeface out of that?
I've had people ask if they can make typefaces out of it. And I don't know if I'm just putting myself out of a job.
Right, yeah. Like, oh, you want how much? I'll just buy the typeface. It's 50 bucks. Yeah.
So, like, it's something that is definitely I've thought about, because I'm like, oh, this. And then I'm like, God, it could save you a lot of time, Kate. You could just type
out
really,
your own typeface. Yeah, really, just for yourself. Yeah.
But there's something that, again, like, it's, and again, this is why I sometimes feel like my workflow really could be streamlined in many ways, hence this antique purchase. But I really like that I don't have a typeface. And I really like that I am drawing everything out. And it is a little, maybe it is a little ridiculous and it takes a little longer than it should, but it's like, I like that. I mean, a lot.
Maybe it's just as a designer, but there's nothing that's more heartbreaking than when you look at something that someone has obviously put a lot of work into designing, and then you see like, and the typeface looks nice and handwritten, but then you look and you're like, there's two E's in a row and they're clearly identical.
I see that all the time.
Yeah, and it's like, oh.
I'm outraged. I like that outrage has never like died down for me. I'm always I see handwritten typefaces. I'm like, oh, the E's and the R's and the T's. It's all the same. Yeah. It's just like, oh, it's so fake. And so it's like, because this one client of mine, Knock Knock, where I draw out all of, I do a bunch of like stationery for them, and it's all hand lettered. And I've had a couple people go, you know, you could have just done that with a typeface. But I'm like, I like the kind of obsessive ridiculousness that there's every single thing that's on that product was drawn by me, and it was fun. And I just feel like it just, I don't know, for me, it makes the piece that much more like kind of like special and thought out mm-hmm. than if you just. So yeah, I guess I just answered my own question. No, I don't want a typeface.
Yeah, I think you did. Yeah.
That's good that I was able to work through that.
Yeah. And that's what we're here for.
Thanks for the illustration therapy.
How are you liking your new workspace with the group?
I love it. Absolutely love it. And it just feels good. We loved being over at ADX. Yeah. Absolutely love that space. Uh-huh. I think it's an awesome, awesome space. But we were getting just a little bit too big for that space, and then going over to the Ford building was a really good move, and it's been really fun to add Jason Sturgill and Tina Snow Lee to the whole thing. Uh-huh. And then Will Bryant, Clifton and I have been working with Will Bryant. He was my student in Mississippi State.
Oh, funny.
Yeah, and Will was in my... I taught him for his very first graphic design class. Like, this was my first... It was, like, my first year teaching at Mississippi State. And then he was Clifton's intern, because Clifton worked over in architecture as a graphic designer, and Clifton hired him as an intern. And so they would sit across the table from each other, like... And then the three of us had a space in Mississippi. And so, like... It was just, and so when he, it's just, he's great. We love him. And
so you guys are okay working in the close quarters
absolutely,
there.
Absolutely. Yeah. Absolutely. Yeah. Will and I, we work back to back, and it's super fun. And it's actually really great because he just graduated with his MFA in studio practice at Portland State. And this is the first time, and we're actually kind of giddy about it. I'm like, we can just be friends. This is awesome. Like, this, he's like, it's really nice. It's really nice. I'm like, yeah, I know. But yeah, it's good. So yeah, to answer your question, it's really good.
So he wants to borrow your Cintiq.
We both, I think I'm going to be curious to see what he thinks about it too, just because we have a similar process. And so, I don't know.
You know, the thing with the graphics tablet is, I actually have a temporary desk right now because I love using the graphics tablet. Mm-hmm. But the funny thing is that I rarely do any design with it.
Yeah.
I'd prefer to draw on paper or whatever.
Yeah.
But at some point I was given one, and I think we didn't have a mouse in the studio I was working in. And it just became such habit. Like, picking up a mouse after that just feels like...
Like this weird, like foreign, like, hockey puck.
Yeah, why would you... Like, when that's available, I just can't see using a mouse. So I've become a big advocate of it, but...
Okay, well, my good friend, Josh Kenyon, he's actually one of the big reasons as to why I'm getting a Cintiq. Mm-hmm. Because he and Colby, they... recently got one about a year ago, and I work with Josh at PSU too, and he was just like going on and on about how just like, this is amazing, it's amazing. And so I was chatting with him a couple days ago, and I was like, Josh, I think I'm gonna do it. And he's like, do it. I said, it's in the cart, I'm clicking, you know, I'm gonna buy it. And he's like, oh my god. But he's gonna show me, because he's like, he's such a awesome, he's kind of like taking the lead on all of the digital illustration classes at PSU. And he's, I always call him a unicorn, because he's like really good at teaching tech in a very fun, creative, and conceptual way. And so it's just like, I'm like, oh my god, you're amazing. I never want you to stop teaching here. But he was great. He's like, come on over, bring your brushes that you use and your pens, and I'll like, we'll load those in. Like, he's like, I feel really good. Like, he's like, oh, nice. It's gonna be great. I'm like,
oh,
okay.
Cool. Okay.
Okay, Josh. Okay.
Great. Well, thank you so much for...
Oh, my God, it's over.
I know, it is. At some point, like, I feel like I don't want the shows to go on too long. But, yeah, I would maybe, like, stop after an hour, and then maybe we'll do it again sometime.
Awesome.
If you're up for it.
But really
it was really lovely to have you here.
Oh, thank you so much.
And what is your website that people should go visit immediately?
It's katebinghamanbert.com.
Excellent. Okay.
So
there should be a stampede of listeners
any
moment. Except we're not live. But.
I like that, except we're not live.
Cool.
Well, thank you so much.
All right, thanks.
That was fun.
you. That's all right, mama, just any way you do. That's all right, that's all right, that's all right, mama.
According to legend, the young singer started riffing on Arthur Crudup's That's All Right. It was late, but the sparks made Phillips sit up and listen. He encouraged Presley to do it again while the tape was rolling. Nothing in American music was quite the same after that. The question of Presley's poaching of R&B and other African-American styles is a real one. Best left to the academics. This much is beyond dispute. The kid with sideburns understood and respected his source material. From the start, he connected the rhythmic gait of rock and roll directly to that of jump blues and R&B and made the result sound like the most natural thing in the world. Have you been enjoying this album?
Yes, I've been enjoying it more than any previous experience with Elvis. I'm not a big Elvis fan.
Yeah,
it was. I feel like Elvis was sort of spoiled for me as a kid. One of my grandmothers, huge Elvis fan, and it was just on all the time. And it was the '80s, and I had like men with makeup and women with giant hair to listen to.
Yeah.
And I didn't want that Elvis, and it just sort of, it always turned me off. It was always on.
Yeah.
So
I know. I think there was sort of, I've always had this sort of line where everything before like the Beatles hit popular music just seemed like that's where I draw the line. Mm-hmm. Everything before that is just kind of boring. You know, it's one of those things that I think we were talking about this like a month ago on this show. Like you just have to, you either listen to music just for pure enjoyment, or you listen to it knowing its context,
mm-hmm.
and then you get more of like an intellectual satisfaction. And I think it's more of that experience with this. It's listenable, but it's also like, it's like, it doesn't even seem to have a drummer. It's almost like skiffle, just like, it's like someone wasn't even allowed to play drums. And it seems like the main rhythm is like the slapback echo on his vocal.
Which is nice and big, and it's kind of, that drives it. Like they don't really need much else in the back. So
yeah, it's like occasionally they let the guitarist take over for a minute, but that's it, you know. So yeah, I wonder who was playing guitar on that.
And these are those early ones. I don't know. You'd mentioned like sort of tracing, you know, the sort of academic way, like tracing things back and finding influences. Liner notes were so good for that, like finding those weird influences and like finding people who... I heard an interview with Johnny Marr over the weekend on the radio, and he was talking about like some folk singer that he loves that he found through the liner notes on some album in the 70s. I'm going to draw a blank. Not a great anecdote here that's happening, but like that sort of happened. But like I feel like every time I would see Elvis, like get to the, I would just be like, it'd skip over it when you'd follow that line down. But this, like, I got the album from iTunes. A little digital booklet would have been nice. Didn't come.
Yeah.
But I would know who was playing guitar on these tracks, probably. That information's probably
there. I loved, you know, I would like a plugin for iTunes that automatically pulls up the Wikipedia page next to whatever's playing.
That'd be great.
Inevitably, I go there and read about it.
I feel like I lament the loss of liner notes every couple weeks. I would probably work past this. it was a big deal in my life, clearly.
It's true. Well, especially in the old ones, it was always like a music critic would write the liner notes. You know, it was almost like a guaranteed glowing review. Even if the record sucked, at least one review was good, the one on the album.
Right.
Like, you'd look at like the back of early Dylan albums, and it was like some writer for the New York Times just waxing poetic about the album, you know?
And then like four albums in, it just became like his stream of conscious
weirdo.
The tarantula excerpts was, can't remember which album that is,
got a little less useful.
Bob got turned on.
It's good. At the same time, I'm like really into like a certain period of new wave right now for some reason. So it's really hard to switch between those. Like I've actually been listening to that second Wire album, like I told you, and this one track by Alex Chilton off Like Flies on Sherbert. The whole album is just a catastrophe, but this one song is like really good.
That song is really, really good.
It's super catchy. I just bought that one song. I'm not going to buy that album, but yeah, it's so catchy. This is one of those tracks, and you know, yeah. So,
yeah, I've weirdly been sort of listening in that. Well, a little later, I guess. I heard Johnny Marr over the weekend on Sound Opinions, which is a great show.
Okay, you know,
yeah. And they interviewed him for like the entire show. He was talking about his new solo album and like just the history of the Smiths and like him moving to Portland and like all this sort of, it was a fantastic interview. But it's just like they kept playing Smith songs and I was like, I love the Smiths. Why am I not listening to the Smiths all the time? So like most of my weekend was spent listening to the Smiths.
That's how I felt when I came in like Friday and you were playing Belle and Sebastian. Mm. I was like, why did I stop listening? I know why I stopped listening to Belle and Sebastian. And this is a dumb reason. I'm going to come clean. It's because I had RDO, and then I canceled it. Mm-hmm. And then I was like, well, I love these albums so much. I'll buy. And there's one in particular I wanted to buy, the one that has, like, Mayfly on it and stuff, mm-hmm. like the second or third one. And I looked on iTunes, because I was like, well, I'll just buy it. I want to own it. And it was like, there's all these complaints in the reviews that, like, one of the tracks is missing, and Mayfly is, like, duplicated, which is why I think that stuck out of my head. So it's like, well, great. Well, I'm not going to do that. I'm not going to buy that. I don't want to buy a bad version. I'm better off just resubscribing. And then that's where it left it. That's where I stopped. So that's the last time I listened to Belle and Sebastian until you played them. It's ridiculous.
Yep.
It's bullshit is what it is. What I should do is find the vinyl and then get a record player hooked up again. Yeah. I've decided to make it more exciting to move to our new studio by taking away the record player. And then when we get there, I'm going to bring my Technics 1200. And I'm going to set it up on some big, beautiful thing by itself.
There's a lot of space in there. Can we get a little dance floor?
Yeah, sure. Yeah. The whole place is going to be like a dance floor.
Someone write that down. The whole place is going to be like a dance
floor. It's recorded. would you like to make our pick for next week?
Yes. All right.
It's exciting. Drum roll, please. I can overdub the...
All right. I've got three options looking at me.
Oh, boy. You got to pick. Don't tell me what
they are. I'm just going with...
You get to pick. It's your prerogative. Whatever's on those facing pages.
Manuel de Falla. Okay. El Sombrero de Tres Picos. Spanish composer.
The hat of the...
The three-cornered hat.
Okay.
I may have grossly mispronounced that to the point where you couldn't translate it. It was originally written to accompany a pantomime.
Wow.
To me, this was the best pick of the three, by the way.
Okay, sure.
Yeah. All right.
Okay.
Mime music.
Wow.
That's what we're going
Wild
with.
Wild card.
Yeah. Classical, originally recorded...
Like flamenco or something?
55. I don't know if it's orchestral or...
Yeah, I don't know what the hell I'm talking about. I just like saying flamenco.
Nothing wrong with that. Yeah, it's symphony. It was it was used after the pantomime for ballets.
What the fuck? You know, speaking of flamenco, our next-door neighbor just got married. And as a surprise, she always had pink flamingos in her front yard. So as a surprise, someone tracked down the service. Apparently, this is a service in Portland that will fill your yard with pink flamingos.
Nice.
Like hundreds. And then they leave like a little sign, you know, like the construction people do. Like, it's like, you know.
Flamingoed by.
Yeah, exactly. So apparently, this is a thing in Portland. You can get flamingoed. Just for like 24 hours. Like then it's
they
gone.
They come and take them?
Yeah.
They come and collect
them?
Oh,
yeah.
Nice.
Yeah.
Wow.
Yeah.
I wonder what that runs.
I know. It's such a weird...
I wonder what is the demand on that? Like, how often are they just...
You know, I got to do that.
Spilling pink all over people's lawns.
I got to get them on the show.
Yeah. There
I'll
you
track
go.
Track that person down. That would be a fascinating interview. Right up there with the Extremo.
Extremo. The day Extremo is on the podcast will be a good day.
I can't believe that. Yeah. I picture, you know, you probably have an image in your head. I do. Do you know who Wavy Gravy is?
Mm-hmm.
That's what I picture Extremo being like. Just like toothless, or like having a few select teeth.
That big W.C. Fields nose.
Like. Yeah, and like a big old stupid floppy hat with like bells. Just like, I'm here to paint your windows. So we'll see.
I have more of a Bobcat Goldthwait as Shakes the Clown kind of
nice.
Image.
I like it, yeah. I like your image better. I'm going to use your image.
A little angrier.
Yeah, mine is more like, you know, an acid casualty. Yours is more like hiding a flask under the jacket.
Exactly.
Still got a couple of punches left in him.
The opening scene of that movie is one of the greatest things ever.
I was, you know, have you been listening to that podcast with Jeff Garlin, by the way?
I have it. I've been catching up,
yeah.
So I'm nowhere near.
It should be called local. A big bowl of X, because he uses that phrase so often.
Really?
Yeah. It's like a big bowl of blank. But, you know, that's fine.
Oh, he's I thought you literally meant a big bowl of X. Like,
oh. You mean like ecstasy?
Like, I like that party.
Wow, yeah. Eat your heart out,
Jeff
Bobcat.
Garland doesn't strike me as an ecstasy kind of
no,
fan.
No, not really. No, I don't even think he has sugar. But his guest this week was Henry Rollins.
Mm.
And you know what his first question was? Do you like to take baths? I'm not kidding. Like, he doesn't even know the guy. I don't even think he's met him, but he's not like a friend. He just like, was like, you should be on my show. Do you take baths?
That is the perfect first question for Henry
Rollins.
It
turns out that Henry Rollins rarely takes baths because he's very concerned about water usage. He tends to take very quick showers. And if they're not hot yet, he gets in anyway because he doesn't want to waste that water.
That's not at all surprising.
No, that is no. So Henry Rollins.
What was the shack where he lived for most of the 80s? Like a 6x6 cell or something? Yeah.
Yeah, he's Hank. Hardcore. Huh?
I said Hank.
Hank.
Good old Hank.
Does he go by Hank?
I don't know.
Oh, okay.
Not on a nickname basis with him. But he should.
He's it's still like name. Tours. He's like in his 50s.
I saw him do, he did like several like spoken word albums.
Mm-hmm.
I saw him tour on some of those like late 90s.
You mean you went to see him?
Yeah.
Were they good?
They were good, but yeah. It was like, he's funny and smart and...
Presumably
like,
they're good. You know? I mean, he makes a living doing it.
Yeah.
Didn't he have a TV show or
he
something?
He did on IFC. That was a good show. He would interview people, and like he would do like film reviews and stuff, and they were, you know...
Huh.
It was interesting.
But it's not on anymore?
I don't think so. I think it was only on for like 2 seasons or something. Like Elvis Costello had a show on IVC, or IFC, for... IVC.
IVC.
for a couple seasons.
Good.
Yeah.
Did you ever see that show that was like LOL Work? Oh, is it?
Oh, was it the Cheeseburger Network Work show?
Yeah. It looks like it was canceled. They only did a season. But I thought it was funny. Oh, well. Such is the life of the show on Bravo.
Mm-hmm.
They've carved out such a strange niche.
Unless you're a desperate housewife of someplace. And then you get endless
right.
seasons.
Yeah. Endless spinoffs.
Mm-hmm. Or a Kardashian.
Anyway.
What were we talking about?
Oh, I don't know.
What
know.
Was the question?
For next week, symphonic flamenco. I just invented it. I'm not even listening. I'm not going to like this. Whatever.
Three-cornered
it
hat.
Yeah. Okay. Maybe I'll love it. Maybe it'll be like the first time I heard Django. I was just like, holy shit, who is this guitarist? This three-fingered wonder. So maybe it'll be like that for me.
Let's hope.
Who's this three-cornered hat man? Yeah, so maybe you should repeat
maybe
that.
Maybe you'll be miming.
Oh, you know what? It'll go on the show notes.
And the books here. It's Manuel de Falla.
You better bookmark it.
Yeah.
This kind of goes with the book now. Manuel de Falla.
So this, goes the bookmarks. All right.
You choose a unique color every time. Oh, you're going on the side. Yeah. It's hard to get.
All right. Nonstop to Madrid Now Boarding is the little title in the book.
Of the, yeah.
Of the description.
Boy, that's great.
Just terrible, really.
I wonder how many albums Elvis put out. We have like, I don't even really like Elvis, and we have like 30 Elvis records here because I inherited them. And they all have the same fucking songs.
Well, they're all like differently released compilations of
exactly. Hits. It's like Elvis and the Color Blue. Elvis in Hawaii. Elvis on the flight back from Hawaii. Giggles says bye.